Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signe Darpinian, co-author of No Way, as well as the forthcoming book, How to Raise Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Today, we are going to talk about shame, what it is, why we have it, and tips on managing it. Joining us is someone who knows a lot about the topic and takes an evolutionary approach to shame, Dr. Norman Kim. Dr. Kim completed his BA at Yale, his PhD in psychology at UCLA, and has developed an expertise in treating and teaching about psychiatrically complex populations. He is a regular national and international speaker, educator, and passionate advocate for eating disorder awareness and legislation, with a particular focus on minority status and barriers to mental health care in marginalized communities. He is the founding co-chair of the Black, Indigenous, and People of Color Committee of the International Association of Eating Disorder Professionals. He's on the inaugural Behavioral Health Task Force for Gay and Lesbian Medical Association and the co-chair of the Transcultural Significant Interest Group for the Academy of Eating Disorders. Norman is the co-founder of Reasons Eating Disorder Center and the Institute for Anti-Racism and Equity. Norman, thank you for being here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Norman, in the introduction, there was mention of you taking an evolutionary approach to shame, and I was thinking that might be a good starting place.
Sure. As I was listening to your introduction, it's funny because it almost sounded like, you know, I just have a lot to be ashamed about, which is in part what makes me an expert. And, you know, I'm joking, obviously, but there's a little bit of truth to that. And it is kind of related to the question you just asked me. You know, in general, when we talk about taking an evolutionary approach, especially to something that's more sort of psychological, I think, you know, most of us probably have a sense of what it means in terms of, you know, species and thinking about species. But you can take a similar approach, because all it really means is looking at evolutionary pressures and drive for success in terms of successive generations in many of our traits. And so anything that we are, any of the ways that we behave, those are all really governed by the same evolutionary principles. Qualities that help us as a species survive tend to get propagated further, and qualities that don't tend to help us survive tend to get sort of weeded out of any particular population. So I think there are a couple of signposts to establish. The time scale of evolution, I think, is important to think about. So, you know, we're talking about sort of millions of years of our evolution when we existed in this very kind of primal, anything could kill you at any moment. And so much of our brains, so much of our behavioral patterns are still really rooted in that, like anything could kill me at any moment. So characteristics that helped us survive in that context are still very much with us. If you think about it on that time scale, it's really only been in the last like 10,000 years or so that we've not had those kinds of immediate threats in our environment. Just to give you a sense of what that means, when I talk about this, I say, you know, I just turned 50 this year, actually, and it would be as if every day of my life up until yesterday, every time I walked out of my apartment in Brooklyn here, there was something ready to kill me. You know, You can imagine that my existence is going to be kind of an anxious existence. It's going to be a relatively scary existence. And you can also probably imagine the kinds of psychological and behavioral traits I would have had to have developed in order to survive, you know, these 50 years when that's my existence. So let's say further that I wake up today, I look out my apartment window, and whatever threat there was that has been there for 50 years, all of a sudden isn't there anymore. Well, I'm not all of a sudden going to be no longer anxious. I'm not all of a sudden going to be happy-go-lucky, because probably that whatever threat was there is still going to be there tomorrow, so I better be ready. In terms of, you know, our time scale of how long we've been around as a species, that's how recently in our evolutionary history We've not had those kinds of threats present for us as a species. So all of those impulses, all of those psychological characteristics that were necessary for our ancestor survival are still very much what rule our behavior and our brains today. And if you think about it from that standpoint, I think it's probably easy to see why anxiety is so difficult to manage, why anything that stokes our anxiety is so feels so immediately present, even if we rationally might know that it's not. And I think we all know this very well, given everything that's happened with COVID this past year and a half, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we've been collectively living in this highly anxious, highly threat-centric year and a half period of time. You know, even though it seems like some people have been able to sort of loosen up, for most of us, we're still kind of living in a state of heightened anxiety. And this is in part the reason why. I mean, you know, we still have a lot to be anxious about is much more the direct reason. When anything kind of triggers that anxiety for us, it really is very difficult to get away from that. And that has everything to do with why shame is also such a primal motivator for us, because, you know, if the reason that anxiety is such an important survival trait is because that is kind of what allowed our ancestors to survive, specifically because it allowed us to work together in groups better to take down much larger predators, right? If you think about, you know, why are humans the species that have been sort of the top of the food chain in our recent history? Well, it's not because we're the fastest or the strongest. It's because we've evolved a way to work together. We're an extremely social species. Mm. And so, in addition to our ability to cooperate and work together, and combined with our sort of innate kind of hypervigilance and all of those other things that we tend to pathologize as anxiety, you know, those are really all of the things that have allowed us to survive to this point. So, you know, sort of taking into account how recently we've not maybe needed those same traits, you can see why anything that is related to those characteristics might remain as particularly potent traits that we still possess. So if you think about, you know, if you buy this argument that, you know, what's allowed us to survive as a species is our ability to work together, a big mm-hmm. element of our ability to work together is also our ability to sort of see someone else's intentions and to see whether someone isn't sort of following the rules. And what are we really talking about? Well, we're really talking about the capacity for shame, right? The way that mm-hmm. shame might be different from something like, something different like guilt, for example, is shame is sort of about a recognition of the other person and of the more abstract other. Shame has this very direct kind of body-focused correlate in that, you know, it's the looking down, averting gaze, those kinds of behaviors that all of us are really programmed to recognize. Well, why is it something that we recognize so instantly? It's related to what I'm talking about. It's because we needed to recognize if somebody had done something kind of transgressive or done something that they weren't supposed to do. It's important for us to be able to recognize that someone's done that. And then further to recognize that they have some sense of understanding that they've done something they weren't supposed to. If those basic rules aren't being followed, then, you know, our social contracts tend to fall apart and we'd stop being able to function cooperatively.
Norman, do you suspect that there was a time when we did not have as much shame and we evolved to have more shame?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think it depends on a little bit on what you mean. I mean, you know, part of the answer is we really don't know, right? Because we're sort of looking backwards in time. I think like before we sort of had some level of of more advanced cognitive abilities, you know, did we have the capacity to experience shame? You know, probably not. If we look at the other thing about shame that people talk about is that it seems to be a fairly uniquely human emotion. Mm. You know, in animals, you can see like submission behaviors, for example. You know, like anybody who has a dog and when your dog does something they know they're not supposed to do, they certainly exhibit some sort of like submission kind of behavior that we tend to anthropomorphize as shame. But You know, can animals really experience shame in the same way? Probably not. From that standpoint, I think there needs to be some level of advanced cognitive ability. You know, I imagine, you know, other primates have some analogous kind of experience, but, you know, again, it's hard to really know. I think for all intents and purposes, you know, when we sort of became Homo sapiens, the way that we would think about it as our current species, probably we've at least evolved the precursors to what we would recognize as shame.
Okay. I was talking to a colleague about it before our conversation today, and I was saying that shame feels a lot like I feel when there's a police officer behind me and the light is going off and I think I'm getting mm-hmm. pulled over. They just end up kind of zipping by me, that just overall immediate body reaction. And I'm not saying right. that, and I don't mean to say that shame feels the same as that. It's just one of the emotions that feels the most immediate in the same way.
Yeah, no, that's actually a great example, because the answer to why both of those things feel the way that they do is threat. We are particularly wired to respond to threat in a very specific way. So anything that activates threat, as far as our bodies and our brains are concerned, anything that activates threat, it doesn't matter if it's a memory. So think about like PTSD. It doesn't matter if it's an actual, like, you know, there's like a tiger and he's looking like he's going to kill me and he's right in front of me. Or it doesn't matter if it's something that you just associate threat to, like a circumstance. So I've been watching the Olympics this week and I'm really fascinated by swimming because I actually have a water phobia. So to me, swimming looks like pretty miraculous because it's something I have such a hard time imagining myself being able to do. But if you think about any phobias that we might have, it's something that technically is relatively neutral, except that for me, I've attached threat to something that other people find pleasurable or at least find neutral in some way. So, you know, it doesn't really matter. What matters is that as far as your experience and your brain is concerned, it's threat. And so anything that activates threat is going to activate that same kind of automatic fight, flight, or freeze response, right?
That makes sense.
Yeah. So the example you give is a great one because, you know, all of us have been in that situation. And what happens? It's not like as soon as the cop passes by you, you immediately calm down. Like, my heart is still racing. My palms are probably sweaty. It lasts for quite a while. And it's because, like, as far as our bodies are concerned, you've activated that whole response and our bodies have gotten ready to engage in some sort of action. And that's why it feels that way. What scientists have kind of found about shame is that it activates the same parts of our brains that physical pain activates. So it's literally painful for us to experience.
Wow.
And I think that's something that intuitively all of us fully recognize. When you have a really sort of shameful experience, it's not just like a, you know, it doesn't just feel kind of bad. It feels horrible.
It's powerful. It feels like, it's different than guilt, you know, and I imagine that those two emotions can be blurred a little bit, but at least for me, it feels very different than an emotion like guilt.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And again, even if you can't sort of give a technical definition of what the difference between the two of them might be, I think, again, intuitively or viscerally, many of us or most of us would be able to say, like, oh, yeah, I can definitely think of like shame, something I'm really ashamed of as being different from something I might just feel guilty about. Even though both things feel bad, they feel bad in kind of different ways.
Well said. Norman, is it true that some people have too much shame and some people have too little?
Sure. I mean, just like any characteristics, like too much versus too little, but some people are probably particularly attuned to or sensitive to experiencing shame. And that can be, you know, there are cultural reasons why that might be. So, you know, I'm Korean American, and Korean culture in particular is something that's considered a particularly high shame culture. A lot of Asian cultures are particularly high shame cultures. And so, you know, sort of culturally, all of the mechanisms through which those kinds of cultural values might get passed down from generation to generation, it's something that I'm particularly sort of attuned to or particularly predisposed to experiencing. And then I think if you have certain kinds of life experiences, you know, if you've gotten shamed quite a bit from a caregiver or from just, you know, life experiences, that can be something that fundamentally shifts your propensity for experiencing it or being wary of of being in a situation like that. And then the other side of your question, absolutely. I mean, I think we can all think about people in our lives that we can think of who don't seem to experience shame when they probably should experience shame. And even though there's some short-term like Machiavellian benefit to not experiencing shame, in the long term, it's impossible to imagine someone having sort of good, healthy relationships if they don't experience shame on some level.
Right.
And so I think when we think about, you know, again, sort of you and I both being therapists, I think it's really important when we think about any of these characteristics or any of these sort of realms of psychopathology, even something like depression or mania or even psychosis for that matter, but certainly anxiety, that we think about them not so much as like there's pathological and not pathological or normal and abnormal, but just, you know, I think it's much more accurate to think about them as these are all traits that we possess, and some of us possess more of them at various points than at other times. And it's a matter more of, is it adaptive for you at a particular moment in time or not? You know, anxiety is incredibly adaptive for things like, you know, it helps you study a little bit longer for a test, or it makes you a little bit more conscientious, or, you know, it's a good thing to, when you're leaving your house, to make sure that the stove is turned off, et cetera, right? But for some people, it sort of goes, it crosses the line and it becomes counterproductive, and it actually can become really harmful to themselves where they're unable to function because it's taken over. But, you know, I think it's important to honor the function that all of these behaviors, you know, probably served for us. Most of the pathologic behaviors in a trauma context or in eating disorders or, you know, really almost anything you can think of in this realm, many of those behaviors serve an adaptive functioning at some point. They help us get through life at some point, but then at some point, maybe we don't need them as much. And it's a matter of, can you scale it back when you need to? And when something has a lot of meaning attached to it, that's when those are the things that are much more difficult to scale back. And that's when people start having problems. So I think that's, you know, this is an important reason why I think taking kind of an evolutionary approach can be really valuable. It takes the judgment piece and it takes a lot of the stigma, at least for me, out of so many of the things that we talk about, because it just puts it into a different context and it allows you to look at something that maybe is no longer adaptive for you now and give you a reason to change it without getting into like, this is some part of me that's broken or that's defective.
If somebody didn't seem to experience quote unquote enough shame, would that be learned? Or is that more, could that also be more biological?
I feel like I'm much more aware of the other end of it. Like,
oh, got it.
What it means that some people have a greater propensity rather than less propensity. But it's hard for me to imagine it truly being, you know, it's hard for me to imagine it truly being hereditary in some way, as opposed to, you know, it makes much more sense that it's learned and it's something that happens over the course of development. And the closest analog I can think to it is psychopathy, right? Like, you know, probably there is some neurologic and biologic basis to psychopathy, but whatever that might be, not everyone who has that particular characteristic ends up being like a serial killer. It just, you know, affects your ability to sort of, you know, interpret social situations in a particular way, your degree of empathy, et cetera. And it seems to me that it, you know, my understanding of that literature is that, you know, you do sort of have to have that trait be reinforced on some level in order for it to manifest. Yeah. So I imagine it's something similar to this. Like if we think about people, you know, I can't think of anybody that comes to mind who I would think of as being somebody who seems to have too little shame that doesn't clearly have some developmental, you know, deep attachment trauma or deep attachment wound in their development. You know, it's, I just, It's just hard. It doesn't make sense that it wouldn't be related more to that.
I don't think that we normally see them in therapy as often.
Right.
Are there emotions that are most associated with masking shame?
Most maladaptive kinds of behaviors that we can think of probably have their roots in shame, right? So, you know, most addiction behaviors, it's hard to imagine them existing without shame. Behaviors where one ends up hurting oneself, whether it's emotionally or physically, it's hard to imagine that existing without shame. And all of those behaviors also have as correlates, you know, a whole host of emotions that go along with it. So yeah, certainly anger, depression, anxiety, as I've talked about. So I think it's more that when shame really becomes a driving part of someone's psyche, that it can manifest in a number of different outcomes. And I think that's probably the best way that I can describe it. And those outcomes tend to overlap with one another as well. But and it's sort of the I think it's more that shame is kind of at the core of so many things, as opposed to having a specific set of negative outcomes it might be attached to.
What about shame specifically in marginalized communities?
Yeah, I think part of, you know, there again, this is a particularly salient conversation to be having, especially this last year and a half, because, you know, in conjunction with COVID and all of the things that have happened as a result of that, you know, we've also seen this really significant increase in at least conversations around social justice and particularly racial inequities and systemic inequities that impact on minority communities. And it's something that's been a big part of my life for as long as I can remember. And I actually think that's the reason I got interested in this work in the first place, sort of coming out of more activism and social justice oriented work in my personal life. And so looking at things like shame just made a lot of sense professionally for me. But I think it's particularly important to understand this dynamic for anybody who interacts with or works professionally with someone from a minority community, because, you know, what's that experience? If you think about what's the threat that's attached with shame in this evolutionary context, well, it's the threat of having your social standing devalued in some way. What's the experience of being marginalized, or what's the experience of being a minority? It's that your social status is threatened because people are constantly pointing out your difference and your otherness and your less than-ness, right? That's the experience of racism. That's the experience of homophobia, of transphobia, of sexism, any of the isms that we can point to. Why are those? It's not just simply pointing out that someone is different. I think this is the place where sort of defensive conversations around things like systemic racism in particular get really skewed. It's not simply a matter of saying someone is different. I don't actually know that we're capable of just simply making an objective statement that, you know, oh, I'm colorblind. I see you as different, but I don't make any value judgments based on that. We just don't operate that way. So the experience of for so many people who are marginalized is over and over again, whether it's through microaggressions, whether it's through, you know, macroaggressions, you know, that is, whether it's through overt acts of discrimination, whether it's through any number of those mechanisms, it's the bottom line message of, you know, you're not just different, but you're lesser than I am. You're not just different, but you're defective in some way because I'm the default, right? That's why we don't want to put you in TV shows. That's why we don't want to put people like you, you know, in charge of companies. I think this is what people who don't understand the upset and the injury that comes from these experiences are not getting. The underlying message that's, even if it's implicit, is still very clear, is the message of you're not just different, you're other and you're lesser than.
you know, how to transition from systematic racism and the shame experienced in general?
I think that's actually a very good question. I think we both have a sense that there's obviously a connection, right? But then what is it? Because they seem like they're quite different. To me, the connection is, I think there is a lot of overlap between sort of how these things play out at a systemic level, at an institutional level, at a societal level, and how they tend to play out individually. And you know, given that parallel, I think it also makes sense that there's something parallel that would happen in terms of thinking about the question of, so what do we do about it, whether it's right. systemic racism or whether it's more my individual shame, because I think there is a parallel answer to both of those questions.
And what would it be? I mean, I know that's hard to, you know, give yeah. one idea about it, because I imagine you have many, but what are some of the most effective ways you have learned and treated shame?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, the answer to both, you know, what do we do about these systemic consequences of our collective shame? Maybe that's one way to think about mm-hmm. it. And then just sort of our individual experiences of shame. And I think the first step in both cases, I think, is a specific kind of introspection. And I don't mean introspection in like a just recognize that just recognizing that this thing is there. I don't know that that's enough in either case. Okay. So for example, when we're thinking about systemic racism and systemic inequities and social justice, you know, I think in that case, it's easy to see the just, you know, I think arguably we're in a place where at least, you know, many people will recognize that those inequities exist. Not everybody, certainly, but, you know, many people do recognize that those inequities exist. I think that insight in and of itself doesn't do anything, which is exactly what we've seen. We've had this, you know, we've seen a big increase in activism. We've certainly seen a significant increase in awareness, but there haven't really been a lot of changes at the systemic level, because I think it needs to be tied to, you know, a deeper looking at your own biases, for example. So when I do, I do consulting and education on anti-racism, and that's always the first thing we ask people to do. It's not just sort of understanding this at an academic level or at an intellectual level, but understanding it in you. What are my biases as a human being? What are my biases as Norman Kim in the world, in all of the contexts in which I exist? It has to be that direct and that personal.
Norman, is there shame in looking at those biases?
Absolutely. And I think that's why it's so hard to do. And I think that's ultimately why people end up not doing it.
I never thought of that. Okay.
Yeah. No one is going to come out of that introspection looking particularly good. And that's not the right point. It's not. Yeah. The point isn't to, like, you know, make yourself feel better about it. I think the point is to try to sort of take as objective a view as possible of yourself and your own biases, because once you can see where your own biases play out, and you have to start with the assumption that all of us have biases, which we do.
Right.
That, you know, then you can start thinking about, you know, okay, so what do I do now that I know that this is there? How do I counteract my own internal bias about this in these situations? You know, first I need to be aware of it. And now that I'm aware of it, I need to figure out different ways that I can react or act in those same situations. And if you think about, like, people within an organization, and if you imagine that, you know, a significant number of people in an organization do that internal work and come to a place of, okay, I know I need to act differently in X, Y, and Z situation, I think it's easy to see how over time that starts to become something that fundamentally changes the culture of wherever, you know, whatever sort of group or organization you're thinking about. That's how systemic change happens.
Norman, thank you for the work that you do and for the advocacy in our field of eating disorders, as well as other fields, and appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me and for letting me talk about these things that are so sort of important for me personally and for bringing light to this. So it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And feel free to contact me at www.signadarpinian.com.